Prepare to be astonished!
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening and welcome back to an adventure in history. We wanted to say that this is the spring 2023 pledge drive week for KMUN.
For KMUN, 40 years.
The 40th birthday edition. Happy birthday, KMUN.
And it doesn't look a day over 25.
It doesn't. And we sound so good all the time. We do love KMUN. I just wanted to point out, though, 1982 was the first membership drive.
Wow.
So I don't have the date of actually when KMUN started. Mm-hmm. Do you think it was prior to that?
Probably,
right? Because then you do the drive after you get it going. I'm sorry. I could keep reading. April 17th, 1983, the first broadcast was from the Gunderson Building on 91.9 FM.
Tomorrow. So as yes. I have repeatedly said, you actually turn the next age the day before your birthday.
Right.
Because your birthday is your day one, so you've completed the year the day before your birthday. So right at this moment, as you and I are chatting and projecting to our vast listening audience, KMUN just turned 40.
Happy birthday. We love it. We love KMUN. They started out with 300 members. They've grown so far. I mean, just so many people are involved now. Individual donors make up 1,200 total.
Wow.
Individual donors. That's just donors. That's not the people like you and I that get to enjoy being on the airwaves for free.
This
is a free service.
I don't know who gets more out of it.
I know. We love it.
That they get a great program to air. We have fun doing this.
We do. We love it. We love it. We love KMUN, and we love being on the show.
I kind of feel like, you know, I mean, it would be weird, but if we weren't being broadcast, I'd still say, hey, you want to come in and we'll just talk into some microphones for 30 minutes every week?
Yes. I mean, you know, I think normal people, Mac, actually do just go out to coffee.
Probably.
Yes. But you and I like the microphone in between. That's We're going to talk more about that and how you can get involved. But of course, always KMUN.org. You can find all sorts of ways to donate cash, credit card, and even donating time.
Of course.
Because volunteers are always needed.
And the thing that people should remember, there's no paid advertising.
Correct.
So we got to pay for these fancy headphones and microphones somehow.
Yep. It's good. We love it. So all 40 years.
Okay, so I've got something I got to pitch as well.
Ooh, yes.
We've got our Thursday Night Talks coming up this Thursday, the April 20th, and it's by Lori Serafin and Eric Wheeler. It's about the Desdemona, all things Desdemona.
Ooh.
The ship, the shipwreck, the sands, the tavern.
I was going to say all things.
It is going to be all things Desdemona. Okay. And that's just fun to say, Desdemona.
It is.
I like to say it.
I have friends that live on Desdemona Street in Hammond.
So, and they probably like saying, we live on Desdemona Street.
Well, and people wonder, though, because the first thing that comes to mind is the tavern.
Yes. That's the first thing?
Well,
it should be
unless
the ship,
you, right. It should be the ship, right? Well, that's why it's in Hammond, right?
That's right. So that's at the Level Tap Room at Fort George Brewery. As always, we're the third Thursday of the month, Thursday Night Talks, TNT. Thursday nights are dynamite. Get it?
Woo-hoo.
And it starts at 7, but the doors open at 6, so you can get some refreshments. And we'll have you home on your way home by 8 o'clock.
Oh, I love that.
So,
are you good about getting people, like?
I am.
Taskmaster.
I am, yes.
I love that.
I'm like a school teacher with a ruler that I start at exactly 7 o'clock when I'm the official timekeeper, when my phone turns to 7, I stick my head out the door and see if anybody's on the sidewalk.
Okay.
I will give them that little window, and then I immediately, if I don't see anybody, I immediately go up front and do a welcome and introductions and start.
And then you end at 8.
And at 8 o'clock, I'll start slowly getting closer to the speaker.
Right.
Because at that point, we're probably taking questions.
Okay.
And at about 5 of, 4 of, 3 of, I'll say 2 more questions or 1 more question. And at 8 o'clock, I'm saying, thank you all. I'm sure they'll hang around for questions.
Right. I was going to say, and of course, the conversations can continue.
Always.
But it could go on forever and ever, right? Because these people are always passionate about what they're talking about.
That's right. And they're always interesting. And, you know, you don't want to make people feel trapped like, oh, I don't want to walk out. There might be a great question and I might. So you cut it off at 8 and then the people can feel free to go, but they can hang around if they want.
Great. And we've had Lori on our show.
We did. That's
right. You can look her up on our podcast.
That's right.
So
if we were a well-oiled machine, we'd know which date it was.
Which day? I'm getting there. I'm getting there, Mac.
Okay. So shall we get through the history highlights?
For tomorrow.
So these are things that happen tomorrow, April 17th, 1790. Benjamin Franklin dies.
Oh.
We did a whole show about him.
Yes.
1865, Mary Surratt is arrested as a conspirator in Lincoln's assassination.
Ooh.
And a lot of historians have kind of debated this. It was her tavern. She was there for all the meetings. I think that's guilty enough.
Okay.
Now, should you be hanged for that? I'm not going to debate that. But to claim like, oh, I didn't know anything about it. No, you were there and you knew everybody there. You were friends with everybody. You were a conspirator.
Okay.
That's my take. 1942. I knew nothing about this, but I like this story. And I'm going to do some research on this.
Okay.
1942. French General Henri Garrard, who was captured in 1940, escapes from a castle prison at Königstein by lowering himself down the castle wall and jumping on board a moving train, which takes him to the French border. Hitler, outraged, ordered Gerard's assassination upon being caught, but the French general was able to make it to North Africa via a British submarine. He joined the French Free Forces under General Charles de Gaulle and eventually helped to rebuild the French army.
Wow.
Don't you want to know more about that?
I do. I mean, the timing of lowering yourself down onto a moving train.
Yeah. And they got to know you were on the train.
Is great timing.
And then how did you get to the sub?
Right, right. They might not have known he was on the train. You could stay on top, couldn't you?
That's true. I mean, they didn't know he got on the train.
Depends what kind of train.
Exactly. And how did he lower himself?
But the sub. I mean, that one.
Into Africa.
You can't sneak on a sub.
I know. There's just so much there that I want to know more about Henry, General Henry. 1961, the Bay of Pigs invasion begins. We could have a whole show on that.
We could have a whole show.
But I have strong opinions. 64, the Ford Mustang debuts at the World's Fair.
Ooh, World's Fair. I didn't realize that. Well, that's fun.
Now, are you at all a car person?
Nope.
See, neither am I, but I have to admit, I love the early Mustangs.
They're fun. They're the ones with the wings, right? Is that the Mustang? No. Is that the Cadillac? See?
That's a lot of things.
But you liked the early Mustang.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I can't justify. I've never had enough money in my life to justify, like, hey, getting a really cool antique car. But if I ever could and would, it would probably be one of the early Mustangs.
Okay.
Let's see. 1970, Apollo 13 returns to Earth. Thank goodness Tom Hanks is safe.
Made a good movie.
Actually, you know, it is a pretty good movie. But if you like that, read one of the books about it, because they had to kind of pick and choose to make it into a movie. But there were literally hundreds of things that went wrong. And they had to keep figuring out, okay, how are we going to deal with this? Okay, how are we going to deal with this next problem?
My goodness.
And just the troubleshooting that they did from afar is truly amazing.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I'll have to look at that. And then in the movie, I mean, there's still lots of things.
Yeah, there's like 5 or 6 things that they kind of figure out.
One after another.
You know, okay, first, obviously, oxygen, you're going to die, so we got to fix that. Okay, well, now how are we going to have enough power? Well, how are you going to do that? The steering's gone. How are you going to do this? And just everything. It really is amazing.
Huh.
1975, Cambodia falls to the Khmer Rouge. Ugh, bad. Yeah. But our history highlight of the day, I think had the most impact, not just because baseball season is upon us again and everybody knows I'm a baseball fan. 1947, on this day, Jackie Robinson bunts for his first major league hit.
Oh.
Jackie Robinson, he is just one of the most amazing people in history to me.
Yes, and we've talked about this before because we said that the bunt for your first hit.
Yeah. And he could do it all. I mean, he could hit home runs, he could hit doubles because he was fast. He was a great base runner. But I love that it was a bunt.
There we go. Good. That is a good one.
I'm going to force my way into this game. I'm going to force my way onto the base paths.
Yep.
So, and the man that had to take so much abuse and was stoic and stood by it and just stood up to it and didn't fight back.
Right. He was a superstar.
Yep. Amazing. Yep. So Jackie Robinson, our history highlight of the day.
Love it.
1947.
Good.
So did I miss anything?
No. We have some other highlights we're getting into next.
So we do. I don't know if we talked about the Oscars.
We did not.
And what was it, like a month and a half ago now?
It was a while ago.
We've had guests and we've had things we had to talk about.
Yes.
So, you know, we operate, the Historical Society operates a little thing called the Oregon Film Museum.
A little thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's in a little building, but it's not little, folks.
It is not little. It's our flagship, believe it or not.
I love it.
It outdraws the other museums combined.
Oh, so that's interesting.
It is. Interesting. Through that tiny little building. It's 800 square feet.
So on that note, do you know who crosses over to your other museums? Like, do you get...
We do, because we sell an adventure and history pass to the Heritage Museum, the Flavel House, and the Film Museum. We sell most of those at the Film Museum.
Okay.
We'll sell... I'm making up stats now, so I'm guessing. But we probably sell about 50 to 60% of them at the Film Museum. And then we probably sell 30-35% at the Flavel House. So really, it is mostly in place to save people money and drive them to the Heritage Museum.
Right. Okay. Well, good. So, that's a good
So we kind of know tool. Those.
Right.
And I don't know the percentage
of just you know,
how
going
many people
to.
Were counting three times because they come through three museums.
Right. Well, in different trips. But I was thinking that one trip, like what gets them to the next one. Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Good. So, Film Museum.
Yes.
You know, we... have many Oscar winners.
We do.
In the state of Oregon.
Because we are known for so many movies.
So we thought we'd talk a little bit about a specific one, but we figure we should give you the background a little bit first.
Okay.
So we have a number of, we're not going to talk about all the nominations, which is even a bigger number, but let's see, Best Picture, we have one win. It was 1975, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
They won.
Of course.
And now that's House Concurrent Resolution 14.
Exactly.
Which we are following, folks. Listen to our last podcast if you want to hear more about that.
So that also won Best Director for Milos Forman in 1975.
And then also won for Best Actor in a Lead Role. Jack Nicholson won for his portrayal of Randall Patrick Mac McMurphy in One Flew Over a Cuckoo's Nest.
What was his nickname?
Mac.
All right. And also Best Actress in a Lead Role.
Oh, yes.
The same year. Of course. Louise Fletcher. She was scary. Won for her portrayal of Nurse Mildred Ratched.
It's all in the name. I mean, and then they cast her perfectly, right?
Yeah.
But that name. I mean,
Ratched.
Oh, it's awful.
So we have had some nominees for Best Actor in a Supporting Role, but no wins.
Yep. Quite a few for Lead Role, even. Lots of nominations, right? Mm-hmm. But does that bring us up to this year?
It does.
Okay.
We've had a number of best animated feature films nominated five times, in fact.
Wow.
But we won one finally this year, Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, which is on Netflix right now. That's where it went to directly streaming to Netflix. That's who bought the film.
Right.
And it's a stop motion. There's a lot of people that I think worked for Will Vinton Studios, the guy that did the Dancing Raisins and the PJs and Mark Twain's Adventures, all stop motion. And he didn't invent it, but he certainly kind of reintroduced it. And a number of people are still around, and they're working at a place called Shadow Machine, among others. There's some other companies, Leica, but Shadow Machine is a Portland company, and they did a lot of the stop motion stuff. And it's a very beautiful film.
Wow.
It's dark. So yes. I mean,
which the Pinocchio, the story is
dark.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. A lot of those.
So it won, and we're excited because it's an Oscar-winning Oregon film.
I love that.
So we thought we'd talk a little bit about Guillermo del Toro today.
Let's do it.
So you might have heard of him, and why? Because he's got a pretty big filmography. He's made some TV as well, but some of the major movies that he's made: 1993, Kronos. His breakthrough is 1997, Mimic, which is a pretty good film. I don't know how many people saw it. 2000.
Are these all stop action as well?
No.
Are they different?
No.
He's very creative.
Very creative.
Okay.
And we'll talk about some of his inspirations and some of the things that are in many of his movies.
Right. Okay.
2001, The Devil's Backbone. 2002, Blade 2.
Heard of that.
With Wesley Snipes as the vampire hunter guy.
Popular.
2004 Hellboy. That's probably one of the better known ones.
Yep. Also didn't see it. But
I don't think you've seen many of these.
Yes.
2006 Pan's Labyrinth. And that has a huge following. Mm-hmm. And that's why a lot of people have heard of him. 2008 he went back to Hellboy with Hellboy 2 The Golden Army. 2013 Pacific Rim was kind of a big budget film.
Yep. I remember that one.
2015 Crimson Peak. 2017 Oscar winner The Shape of Water.
Ooh.
So okay. A lot of people know from that. 21, Nightmare Alley, and then 22, Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio.
That's a lot of movies, too. I mean, without a lot of breaks.
He has been very busy in his life.
Oh, my goodness. So Guillermo del Toro was born October 9th, 1964, in Guadalajara, Jalisco, Mexico. He was raised by his Catholic grandmother. Del Toro developed an interest in filmmaking in his childhood. When he was 8 years old, he began experimenting with his father's Super 8 camera, making short films with Planet of the Apes toys and other objects.
I love that. That cracks me up. He's right? Got like action figures and things, and he's making these little stop motion with his dad's camera.
At age 8, right? Perfect. One short focused on a serial killer potato with ambitions of world domination. It murdered Del Toro's mother and brothers before stepping outside and being crushed by a car.
I would pay to watch that movie.
So this is where it's a little disturbing, because is he 8 when he makes this?
I think sometime after age 8, but probably young.
But even still.
He's probably like 11, 12, 13.
So he's getting
point.
That sort of dark creative from the early on. Okay. While attending university, he published his first book, a biography about Alfred Hitchcock. Later, he learned about makeup and effects from the legendary Dick Smith, The Exorcist, and worked on making his own short films. At the age of 21, Del Toro executive produced his first feature, Donna Harlinda and Her Son. That was in 1985. Del Toro spent almost 10 years as a makeup supervisor and formed his own company, Necropia, in the early 1980s. He also produced and directed Mexican television programs at the time and taught film.
I'm always amazed. Age 21. You know what I'm doing at age 21? I'm working for the Boy Scouts and singing Alfie the Spider around a summer campfire.
Not all of these things.
So Del Toro has directed a wide variety of films, from comic book adaptions, Blade 2 and Hellboy, and a sequel, Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, to historical fantasy and horror films, two of which are set in Spain in the context of the Spanish Civil War under the authoritarian rule of Francisco Franco. These two films, The Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth, again, one of his most well-known, are among his most critically acclaimed works. They share similar settings, protagonists, and themes with the 1973 Spanish film The Spirit of the Beehive, widely considered to be the finest Spanish film of the 1970s.
Wow. So he got his first break when Cronos, in 1992, won 9 Ariel Awards. Now, this is the Mexican equivalent of the Oscars. Then went on to win the International Critic Week Prize at Cannes. Following this success, Del Toro made his first Hollywood film, Mimic, 1997, starring Mira Sorvino. Del Toro had some unfortunate experiences working with a demanding Hollywood studio on Mimic and returned to Mexico to form his own production company, The Tequila Gang. I like that name. Next for Del Toro was The Devil's Backbone in 2001, a Spanish Civil War ghost story. The film was hailed by critics and audiences alike, and Del Toro decided to give Hollywood another try. In 2002, he directed the Wesley Snipes vampire sequel, Blade 2. On a roll, Del Toro followed up Blade 2 with another successful comic book-inspired film, Hellboy, in 2004, starring one of his favorite actors, Ron Perlman. Del Toro is divorced, has a daughter and son, and lives in Los Angeles and Toronto.
I like that one of his favorite actors is Ron Perlman.
I know.
I mean, I like Ron Perlman. He's good in what he does. But it just seems kind of a
interesting
funny
side note.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So we've got, these are kind of random.
Okay.
Just fun facts about his life, his work, things like that.
Good.
So his movie and comic book collection is so huge that he had to buy an extra home to accommodate them.
Oh my goodness.
Now see, I want to see his comic book collection.
So see, this also could be why he's divorced.
It might be.
That alone.
But he put them all in another house, so it's not like she's tripping over them.
Exactly. Well, okay. He fought the film studio for almost 7 years to get Ron Perlman for the title role in Hellboy 2. In 2004, the studio wanted a bigger name to ensure the success of the movie, but Del Toro thought Perlman was the perfect choice and he wouldn't make the movie if he wasn't cast.
I kind of agree. I mean, I think he is kind of perfect for the role. And Hellboy is a good movie. Following his international breakthrough, his father was kidnapped for ransom in Mexico in 1997 and held for 72 days.
Oh my gosh.
Until the money was paid. Fellow filmmaker James Cameron helped secure the ransom money. Although Del Toro still frequently works in Mexico, he has relocated his family to the United States out of fear of more kidnappings. Isn't that astounding? 72 days.
That's awful.
That's very scary.
Good friends with director James Cameron. Cameron did help him pay that. And then he once revealed that he nearly got into a fight with Harvey Weinstein over the latter's treatment of Del Toro's during the filming of Mimic in 1997. It's not the only one that didn't get along with him.
Not only the only one. But it does kind of speak volumes.
It does, right. Yeah. The one good guy. There you go. He turned down a chance to direct Blade Trinity in 2004, Alien versus Predator, also Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, to work on his dream project, which was Hellboy. He also turned down the chance to direct I Am Legend, One Missed Call, another Harry Potter, the one Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, and Halo, to work on Hellboy 2, The Golden Army. So he wanted to do those.
See, I like that he either has faith in his projects, or he's at a point in his life where I'm going to work on the things I like and I want to.
Yep.
And those are certainly passion projects that did well for him, I hope.
Because these are all, I mean, those are all huge movies.
Yeah. So he became a vegetarian after seeing the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But only for 4 years. Currently, to our best knowledge, he's no longer a vegetarian.
Okay. Yeah, no comment. He has a photographic memory. In an article in USA Today, August 22nd, 2011, Del Toro listed his 6 favorite fright films. Freaks from 1932, The Uninvited from 1944, The Innocents, 1961, Jaws, 75, Alien, 79, and The Shining, 1980, which
an Oregon film.
Yes, exactly. It counts.
I've not seen The Uninvited or The Innocents.
No.
But those are really good choices.
Yeah.
Because I don't like, I'm not a fan of Jason and just stabbing and ooh, scary, and we shot you and somehow you're still alive and you're going to come and stab me again. I like thoughtful stuff.
Right. It definitely seems, I mean, these are all sort of not my style, but they're creepy because there is some like, something that could be real about them, right?
Yeah. So he used to work as an orderly at a mental institution and would eat lunch in a morgue next to them. That's bad.
He has extensive knowledge and practical experience playing video games and is very good friends with Japanese video game designer, director Hideo Kojima, with whom he shares many interests, including those 1960s classic movies and Japanese television series and rare toys. When casting his films, he looks for interesting, engaging eyes in a prospective actor or actress.
He regards Mimic from 97 as the weakest of his films and blames constant interference from the producers Bob Weinstein and Harvey Weinstein as the main reason, because they didn't respect his artistic vision. He later made peace with the film after creating a new director's cut.
Oh, interesting.
Who knew there were two Weinsteins? As if one wasn't bad enough.
Oh, yeah. They started out, their business started together in New York. Yep. Was attached to direct The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, in 2012, but dropped out due to repeated delays in the production and the project stalling due to MGM declaring bankruptcy. He still received screenwriting credit on the film and its sequels, The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, and The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies.
I wonder what it would have been like if he had directed those. It's very interesting. Or any of the other movies that he turned down. His favorite movie monsters are Frankenstein's monster and The Creature of the Black Lagoon. I've never thought about what my favorite
movie monster
would be. I'm going to have to give that some thought.
Ooh, there's a good Halloween show right there. In 2008, he became the 4th Mexican director to have won Best Director at the Academy Awards in the last 5 years. When asked what movies he would make, given the proper budget, he said, At the Mountains of Madness and Frankenstein.
I would like to see his version of Frankenstein.
Right.
That would be really good. So The Shape of Water from 2017 is his favorite, personal favorite of his own movies. Favorite albums, for no apparent reason, we're going to share, are The Wall by Pink Floyd and Security by Peter Gabriel.
Very different styles. His favorite movies include Nosferatu.
One of the first Dracula movies or vampire movies.
Okay. Freaks, The Bride of Frankenstein, The Seventh Seal, Eyes Without a Face, 8 and a Half, and Brazil.
Now, see, I've seen Nosferatu. I've seen The Seventh Seal, The Bride of Frankenstein. I've not seen Eyes Without a Face, so I can't comment on whether those are good choices or not.
Yep. He was going to direct Thor in 2011 for Marvel Studios, as he was interested in exploring Norse mythology, but dropped out because he couldn't commit to it long term. But that does seem like out of his like realm too, right?
A little bit, but the comic book thing. So.
That's true.
And
that's true.
We've discussed, although not with you, we've discussed my opinion of Thor. And I love Thor. He's one of my favorite comic book characters, even before the movies, because I'm a comic book geek from way back. But I'm always, while I think the casting is good, my question is, how come Thor doesn't have a Norwegian accent?
Oh, interesting.
Why does he have an English accent? I am Thor. I'm here to fight Thanos. I need somebody with a really good Norwegian accent to do that for me.
To do it. Okay. Yes. Not here.
But it's a burning question. Think about it.
That's a good one.
Why does he have an English accent?
Not sure. Okay. So roughly 16 years of his life have gone writing and co-writing screenplays for movies that never got made.
But they may. Someday.
That's true. 16 years of his life. His name translated into English is William of the Bull.
I like that.
That's why he's very straightforward.
Yeah. He became the first filmmaker to win Academy Awards for Best Director, Best Picture, and Best Animated Feature for different films. So some of the things you'll find in his movies, in case you've not seen all of his movies.
No, right.
Some things that happen a lot. He often uses insects or insect imagery.
Oh, interesting. He uses a lot of religious relics or artifacts, always mentions Catholicism, archangels, symbols, and other religious items. Many of his films have major scenes based in underground areas, such as subway systems, sewers, or large basements.
He likes to use amber as a dominant color in his movies. Oh. This is especially noticeable in Blade 2 and Hellboy. Clockwork designs and motifs. And the captain's obsession with his father's watch in Pan's Labyrinth is another example.
He often casts Federico Lupi, Ron Perlman, and Doug Jones. And he frequently works with the cinematographer...
Guillermo Navarro.
Okay. One or more of his protagonists are often strongly and pivotally influenced by their father figures.
His works often feature horrifying but visually striking creatures with noticeably inhuman appearances.
His films often show an autopsy or have a scene set in a morgue. The autopsy is often performed on a non-human character. Films often feature a portal that lead to different worlds, often depicts disturbing and graphic face trauma in his films. I would think that the makeup, remember he had that background in makeup artistry.
Special effects makeup, yeah.
Use of gothic architecture in his production designs. Monsters in his works are often sympathetic despite their nature and often horrifying appearances. He casts non-American actors as American characters often, and his films have sinister or outright evil parental figures.
So, streaming on Netflix now, Oscar-winning.
Yes.
Oregon made Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio. It's an Oscar winner. Best animated film.
Oh, that's so
again, it's a very pretty film. It is dark.
Yeah.
So I don't know what age I would if I had little
kids. It's
the
story of Pinocchio.
But it is the story of Pinocchio.
Right.
So and there's an appearance of Mussolini.
Oh.
And he makes Mussolini look very stupid. So I like it. But I'm just so excited. Another Oscar winner.
I love it. And I love talking about it here because we have this platform on KMUN. Remember, it's Pledge Week. Go to KMUN.org. We love being a part of your night. We love being in your car for podcasts. And that is thanks to KMUN. And we are so happy to be with you.
Dig deep into your wallets. Go make some history. We'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for an adventure in history. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.